This is the second class on the heart of remarriage with the bonus of children, and this is going to be highlighting finances, sex and children, delight or destruction. I know in remarriages that there definitely is the want for God to fully bless sexual union in remarriage, free from guilt or recrimination, because remarital sex can also be accompanied, and we talked about this in the first class, the ghosts of marriages past. In order to cast these ghosts outside of your bedroom for good, it's important to have some tips to not get caught in the past. Don't make comparisons in your mind or out loud. Why can't you touch me the way John did? That isn't going to breed confidence in your new partner. Keep your comparisons to yourself. Nor should you linger on comparisons in your own mind. Doing so keeps you looking back instead of connecting to the moment at hand. You know, there is actually a soul tie prayer that is written by Neil Anderson, and he is the author of Victory Over Darkness and Breaking the Bondage. I would recommend that prayer. And this is when there has been a very unhealthy soul tie. This is where sexual issues within a marriage were very abusive. And I will often use that to help folks clear and let the Lord Jesus enter into this area of their life when they are in remarriage. Also, stay open to new preferences. Your new spouse's sexual preferences may vary from the previous marriage. Don't think that what worked with your former spouse will work again. Listen to verbal and nonverbal messages telling you your spouse's preferences. Calm your insecurities. If you were sexually rejected or traumatized in the past, be careful not to let your insecurities or anxiety run ahead of you. Give yourself time to develop a couple groove, learning to read each other. When to respond with a specific touch or what your couple sexual style is will take time. Learn as you go. Share what you learn. Confront your sexual goals. Don't be quick to make negative assumptions and your partner's motivations or behavior. When fearful, try to take some small risks to increase your willingness to trust. Don't ignore sexual problems and don't overreact. It's normal for couples to have a sexual complaint of some kind. Don't panic if you encounter difficulty. Talk it through. And if necessary, find a counselor to refer to. And that would be some of the words that I bring to my folks. I was thinking about a couple I was working with, and this woman, her husband had been unfaithful. And it started with some cell phone issues where she found some text, and then she went to the phone company and found a number of calls to not healthy extensions, and on and on. And it led to an uncovering of quite a sordid connection with unhealthy sexual issues and addiction for this husband. Unfortunately, this happened before I ever had met this couple and there was a divorce. Well, I met this woman's new husband, and they had been remarried, and there was blended family. And there were so many issues that came up in our therapy about his cell phone. And there never was any wrongful texts, and there never was any issues that were ever necessarily found. Sometimes it would be as simple as he would leave his phone in the car. She would think he was hiding something. Or he would turn his phone off at night, and she would say, "You're turning it off because you don't want me to see something." Or if she couldn't reach him, she would automatically assume that something was going on. And this was because she was very reactive to something that had been very fearful in her past. That took a lot of counseling and talking and reassurance to gain trust in her new marriage. It is very important to have common values about the spending and saving of money. This can be a strong factor in what unites or divides a couple. This is more complicated in remarriage, as financial history with assets and debts is something brought into the marriage separately. In her book, Money Advice for Your Successful Remarriage, Patricia Schiff Estes reviews five stages of trust, first identified by Anita and Edward Metzen. Let's look at those. The rose-colored glasses stage. In those romantic first moments, money talk seems crass or unimportant because the strength of love will handle everything. That's a little naive, and there will be no money conflicts, and that's a little ignorant. The don't rock the boat stage, feelings of resentment or anger surface. Frequently, such thoughts as, "Why should I resent his paying alimony? I knew about it before we got married, so that's not going to bother me." Or, "I can't stand her cheapness when it comes to gift giving. I like to give the best, but then never really dealing with it. This is not voice," for fear that any stress would put too much pressure on the fragile new union. And those are absolutely issues that should be talked about. The lay it on the table stage, couples painfully express their concerns to each other, feeling it's okay to be honest, to argue about spending priorities, and to speak candidly about their feelings, frustrations, and fears surrounding finances. A foundation of trust is being laid, albeit roughly. How about the gain it together stage? The couple has arrived at a mutually agreed upon lifestyle and has established an effective method of handling finances and making financial decisions. This does not necessarily mean that they've commingled funds, just that they have agreed on contributions, both monetary contributions and contributions of time, and that they have a system in place for managing both jointly owned and separately owned property. I had a couple that came into their marriage and they were in their middle age years, and both had quite a bit of assets that were separate, and they decided they would keep things separate and even have separate bank accounts for a time being, and this was working with a financial advisor. However, with the counseling, I was hoping that there could be something. I said to them, I'm not a financial counselor, but if there could be something that you would be willing to commingle a little bit and just see how it goes. Well, they decided that they would jointly pay the utilities together and jointly pay the mortgage together. So they set up a separate bank account, and they were going to put a certain amount each month into that account to cover utilities and to cover the mortgage. Well, he was excellent about doing this, but she was not. And oh my goodness, did that start to bring up issues. I think it was partly because she still did not trust. And she was willing to even go down to the bank and pay her half. She did not want to put it into an account where he had access to. And there was much tension. That couple ended up stopping therapy, and I didn't see them again. And it was about 5 years later, they came back into therapy, and unbeknownst to me, they had achieved the stability stage. The couple really feels in control of finances, and despite the ultimate instability of anyone's financial position, they now feel comfortable adjusting their goals or spending patterns as circumstances require. And they were not in instability, but neither one of them were open in the beginning stages of their marriage, and she was probably even less. As they did some work with their pastor and actually had more time in their marriage, their perspectives were integrated, and they started to be able to have more joint finances and actually joint accounts. Here's a picture, because I want to get into now a little bit more about blended families and children. And I thought we'd all remember the Brady Bunch, a hallmark of step families and blended unions. How about you are in a step family if the dynamics fall into one of these formations? This is the definitions. Both the husband and wife have divorce histories. At least one has young children to nurture. Most often, both have children in the formative years. Or one spouse has been divorced and has children, and the other spouse has not previously been married. Or there's a previously divorced husband or wife with children, has a married partner who has lost a mate to death and is still rearing children. Perhaps it's a divorced parent who is co-parenting with an ex-spouse. This single parent and his or her children are dealing with the remarriage of the ex-spouse. Or you have grandchildren from an adult child who is divorced, remarried, and whose ex-spouse is remarried. How about this picture? Where is the synchronicity and where is not the synchronicity? I don't think the children are looking very supportive, but we have a new marriage on that bench, and there's the husband and wife. What do people that are in remarriages have in common? They have a child to care for. A remarriage of people who had previously raised their children with another spouse. Obligations involving money. Another family who has significance in decisions and plans, and the challenge of loving other people's children. And then there's a balancing act of tug and war. A parent cannot be expected to quit caring for a child just because of remarriage. A need to learn to live by new rules. Much like people living in a new country, the old way will not work in this new family. Living with new hope. There is a God who can help us. We just need to make Him the centerpiece of the journey. I wanted to talk a little bit about some step family myths. Love occurs instantly between the child and the step parent. If we ponder on this, we recognize that establishing relationships takes time, that it does not happen overnight or by magic. I have a relatively, it was a newer remarriage on my caseload, and actually the biological mother's daughters were adults. And her new husband, so this would be the daughter's step-parent, very much wanted to have a relationship with the daughters. They ended up telling me about an excursion where they had went to a park, and they had taken their bikes, and they went for a nice bike ride. And during the bike ride time, they found that there was some extra conversation that was taking place, and this was with one of the daughters and the new stepdad. However, when the stepdad came to session, he was very disillusioned, and he felt like the relationship was not going well, and he had lost a lot of hope that there was going to be a relationship for him and the stepdaughter. And I said, well, how long was the conversation? He said, about 30 minutes. And I said, well, how many times have you met her? He said, this is my second time. I looked at him and I said, please give this more time. This could take anywhere, this could take a year. Some statistics say it could take up to 4 years. So that was helpful because he definitely did not have the timing perspective. How about a step-parent is so much more than just a parent. They have made the choice to love, and they didn't even have to. How about the myth of stepmothers are wicked? This myth is based on fairy stories that we all hear as children. Research tells us that stepmothers have the most difficult role in the family. Actually, there have been some longitudinal studies of step-family life by psychologists James Bray and Mavis Hetherington and sociologist Constant Ahrens. It shows that kids of all ages resent getting a stepmother more than getting a stepfather, and that they resent her for longer. In Hetherington's study, less than 20% of adult stepchildren said they felt close to their stepmothers. And while more than half of adult stepkids told Ahrens they were happy about mom remarrying, less than 30% were happy that daddy had. You know, I wanted to give a little bit of a buffer to this. I was doing some research, and I found a blog. And it comes from birthwithoutfearblog.com. And this is a story about the day I became mom, and I thought this was a wonderful example of being a stepmother. Rick and I moved in together about a year and a half, and we were going to be married. And with getting married, and believe me, I didn't like that part, but I did like how she was preparing to get to know this stepson. They were married in September of 2008, so this is a while back. When we began dating, he asked if I was okay with waiting to meet his son. Of course, I was. I understood. I was only 18. He was 27. I wanted to make sure that this was going to last before we included anyone else, especially his child. He was being a good father by making sure I was going to stick around before he brought his child into the picture. This made me love him almost instantly. What woman wouldn't swoon over the idea of a man being a great father? The day I finally meet Ricky was on Super Bowl Sunday 2003, and a month after Rick and I decided to be exclusive, he was 7 years old. He had the best manners. He even called me ma'am. He also met my parents, brother, and sister that day, too. In preparation for our meeting, I went to Target, and I bought a big Tupperware container, bubbles, crayons, coloring books, some outside balls and paints. I decorated the box with his name. When he came inside, I showed him the box and let him know it was his, and it was here for him whenever he came to hang at my house. He was so excited that I have thought of him. Later in the afternoon, he seemed a little bored. He was watching football, so we went for a walk around the block. We brought the bubbles so we could blow them as we walked. We talked about random things at first, and then he said, "Can you promise not to fight with my dad in front of me? I hate when my parents fight. It makes me so nervous." I almost started crying. How could a child so innocent and sweet even understand all that had happened in his life so far? I stopped blowing the bubbles. I turned to look at him, and I promised him wholeheartedly that I would never fight with his dad in front of him. His response was, "Great, I really like you." And I said to him, "I really like you too, Ricky." I called him my son because that is what I feel he is. He is my son. I may not have carried him in my womb because then, about 5 years later, they did get married. I may not have birthed him, but he is mine. Having a child does not necessarily make you a parent. Raising one does. I have raised him. I've gone to parent-teacher conferences. I've been up with him in the middle of the night while he was sick. I've wiped ears and I've kissed boo-boos. I've assisted in helping him navigate teenagehood and brought him to adulthood. I've watched him grow from a young boy into a handsome, respectful man. And that is from a stepmother. How about myth number three? Adjustment to stepfamily life occurs quickly because stepfamilies are such complicated families. The time it takes for people to get to know each other, to create positive relationships, and develop some family histories is significant, usually at least 4 years. And that cannot be shortened. That is very, very important. Part-time families are easier. Relationships take time. Step families where the children only visit occasionally are hampered by the lack of time to work on relationships. And that's another issue. Please don't think that this is going to go fast because it doesn't. And it is very important to make sure that you give it the time that it needs. Now, I do need to speak about core parenting in the midst of divorce because that's often the case and it needs to be there and be present. There are three concepts that should be in place in terms of managing and guarding the emotions of the children. Parents are able to bring their marital relationship to an end without excessive conflict. That would be a very good scenario. Children are not put into the middle of whatever conflict exists. And there is a commitment from parents to cooperate on issues of the children's material, physical, educational, emotional, and spiritual welfare. You will never lose your children's affection. Blood is very, very thick and nearly impossible to erase. Your children will not forget about you just because they have a new, rich, and entertaining step-parent. Your parent. You would have to intentionally be a royal, not very nice person, before your children will consider leaving you behind. Never make your children regret having affections for the other home. Remember that they have citizenship there. And forcing a loyalty battle only destroys them. Children need your permission to love their biological parent, your divorced spouse, and they need to see your psychological stability as they do so. Your permission to do so takes them out of the emotional tug of war and relieves the pressure to take care of you. They also need your acceptance of the relationship that they carve out with their step-parent. The more comfortable you are with a children's relationship in the other home, the more likely it is that they will honor you and your new spouse. Relax and let your children open the circle of insiders to include your new spouse. And if you have children who are protecting an underfunctioning parent, do not try to force them away from the other parent. While your desire to remove your child's need or to rescue is valid, coaching your child away from the other parent feels to the child like betrayal. Express concern and gently help them to decide what their boundaries with the other step-parent should be. Working with a family in the past, it was a blended family. They had two biological children themselves, and then the mother and the father had two biological children from previous relationships, and it was a boy for the father and a girl for the mother. The boy lived with the biological mother, and I could see that my couple were very concerned because this mother was very needy. However, they continued to be supportive of that, and they had time to spend with that son whenever they could. And he did turn out to be quite a caretaker, and there were probably aspects of it that weren't as healthy, but definitely he had quite a concern for people because he had been such a strong influence for his biological mother. I did get to spend some sessions even with this son and talked about how to become healthy himself and when support for people, now that he was looking more at a marriage himself, could be helpful and when it could be more codependent. And that ended up being some extremely healthy conversations for his marriage. For an in-depth look at this subject, please refer to Dr. Don Partridge's book, Loving Your Stepfamily. He is an expert in this field and has much to say about nuclear and biological bonding. In Loving Your Stepfamily, he says, when a child is born, a powerful lifetime biological bond is formed between the child and parent. Parents may establish close, loving relationships with other children, but those relationships do not compare with the connection parents have with their own children. The bond between parents and children and the bond between married couples are considered to be identical. The Bible makes no distinction between the two. The one flesh bond between couples is considered by the Bible to be the same as the one flesh bond between parent and child. Children have a God-given bond with their biological parent. A child's bond to the parent should not be forced to change because of divorce. The child did not ask for this, and the child would be in danger if the child was not protected from this. Children are to be disciplined also by the person they are biologically bonded to. Now, that doesn't mean that the step-parent can't be a part of this. I had one couple that were quite adept at this. There was a teenage boy, and the mother was the biological mother, and oh my goodness, could he go through cars. And her new husband, the stepfather, had quite a finesse for cars. How, when this teenager was not telling the truth, "Oh no, Mom, I didn't have the car out there," and they'd find broken parts on the car. One time they found some fur that was in the car because evidently this boy had had it out in the two tracks and caused some damage. However, how they handled it is the mother would talk to the stepfather later. He would give her some ideas. They would be in agreement how these issues needed to be handled, and that's how it went down. So the new marriage, the mother and stepdad stayed very connected. And yet there were still some consequences and ownership for the son as well. Children need time and attention from the person they are bonded to so the relationship can continue to grow and the child's loss can be minimized. Adults divorce adults, but they do not divorce children. The bond is not to be broken. Step-parents must learn to respect and honor the bond that their new spouse has with his or her biological children, allowing their relationship to continue to develop and thrive. Step-parents and remarried parents must accept the natural bond that the children have with a non-custodial parent, as this bond is every bit as important as the bond the child has with the parents with whom they live. Messing with the bond will lead to trouble, because in so doing, you are tampering with powerful loyalties, God-given loyalties between parent and child. You know, we have been establishing the insiders who are biologically related and those who are not. Outsiders often feel like they don't belong, and they frequently try to force their way in with the insiders. The biological parent in stepfamilies maintains a relationship to both insiders, their children and outsiders, new spouse and his or her children, and therefore must position the stepparent as his or her teammate.